Hi, I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio, where we talk about, you know what? I actually read this every time I get to a show, and this morning I forgot to put it out. So much stuff going on this morning. Here we go. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio, where we talk about how to thrive in a toxic world and live toxic free. There. Okay. Lots going on. You know, there's lots going on in my life. There's lots going on in the world. The first thing I'd like to say is that I'd like you to go to my website, go to toxicfreetalkradio.com, and you'll see that you can sign up for my newsletter. And I have this newsletter that goes out every Tuesday. And if you sign up for the newsletter, it'll tell you all the shows that are coming up that week. And it also tells you different things that I've been posting, new things that I post on my website. I have a Q&A blog where people ask questions and I answer them. And I'm always posting new websites where you can buy toxic free products. And I'm particularly saying this today because this morning I have like four or five really incredible things that I'm going to be posting next Tuesday in the newsletter about electromagnetic fields, about cell phones, about toxic chemical exposures. And there's so much going on in the world. There's new ways that people are labeling organic foods. And by subscribing to my newsletter, well, you hear about a lot of it from my guests. But if you subscribe to my newsletter, you can hear about a lot more things that I'm posting on different areas of my website and just keep up with all of this. And you can also, you know, sign up for my Facebook and Twitter and all those things. Just go to my website and find out what the other resources are in addition, because I'm just so excited to be giving you all this new information. I'm really excited about what's coming, what's happening in the world and what other people are doing. Anyway, we've got a great guest today. All the guests are great. But I just have to say that because every time we have a guest, I think that they're a great guest. That's why I chose them to be on the show. It's Thursday, October 16th, 2014, and we're going to be talking today about making your own fermented foods. This is something that I do at home sometimes, and one of the reasons why I wanted to have my guests on today is because I want to find out more about how I can do this on a regular basis, because I think it's such a good idea and there's so many benefits. I just get tripped up sometimes, so hopefully we'll have some troubleshooting here as well as find out why you should make fermented foods and all their benefits and some fermented foods that you can make pretty easily. My guest today is fermentation revivalist Sandor Katz, and I became aware of him a few years ago when I read his first book, Wild Fermentation. And I consider this to be the basic book on the subject that everyone should have. And if you're listening to this show and you're not fermenting foods, I highly recommend that you just go buy Wild Fermentation and get going, because you're going to find out why you should be eating fermented foods today. He also has another book called The Art of Fermentation, which received a James Beard Award. And that looks at different types of fermentation throughout the world. I haven't read that book yet, but it sounds very interesting and the kind of thing that I'd like to read. So, hello, Sandor. Thanks for being here.
Hi there, Deborah. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Well, tell us first, how did you get interested in fermentation? I mean, I consider you to be like the leader of fermented foods in the world. You're welcome. So I know being one of the leaders of, well, I could actually call myself the leader of toxic-free products in the world, because when I first started 30 years ago, nobody was writing about this or talking about it or thinking about it. And I think that maybe you were in that position too of how did you just, in a world where people weren't talking about fermented foods, how did you get to be interested in it?
There were a few stages of the development of my interest in it. And I mean, I would say that, you know, really this isn't a world where nobody was talking about fermented foods, because you know, probably everybody listening to this, you know, eats and drinks products of fermentation every day, and they're so thoroughly integrated into, you know, our food practices that, you know, we've just all eaten fermented foods for our whole lives, whether we've been talking about it or not. So, you know, bread
or whether
is
we're aware
bread
that
is fermented, cheese is fermented, yeah. Cured meats are fermented, condiments involve fermentation, coffee is fermented, chocolate is fermented, beer and wine are fermented. So, I mean, you know, nobody really goes through their life or really not even their day without, you know, encountering products of fermentation. But the question is one of awareness and practicing it. So, you know, like
yes.
all aspects of food production, fermentation, you know, largely started disappearing from people's home kitchens and communities, you know, increasingly over the course of the 20th century. And it just got concentrated into, you know, basically factories and centralized production. And at the same time as this was happening, you know, we developed this, you know, amazing fear of bacteria.
Yes.
so people began to project all of this fear on the process of fermentation. So not only was it not being done around them, but then they began to imagine that it's, you know, something that's really dangerous and technically demanding. I got interested in, I would say, in three phases. I mean, first of all, in my youth, growing up in New York City, I loved sour pickles. It was just a favorite food mm-hmm. of mine. You know, basically cucumbers fermented with garlic and dill and salt and nothing else. And the acid is not acetic acid, the vinegar acid, but rather lactic acid that develops through fermentation. And I just always have been drawn to that flavor. Nobody in my family was making it. We were able to buy, you know, in local delicatessens, we could buy beautiful pickles, but nobody in my family was making it. You know, then in my 20s, I started following a macrobiotic diet for a few years, and macrobiotics places a great emphasis on the digestive benefit of eating pickles and other kinds of live culture foods. And it was through macrobiotics that I first started thinking about, you know, the idea that there might be health benefits from the pickles that I grew up with and other kinds of live ferments. And I started noticing that when I ate these foods, or really even if I just smelled them, you know, I could feel the salivary glands under my tongue squirting out saliva. And so, I just started noticing in a really tangible way, you know, how these foods got my digestive juices flowing. But what really got me making my own ferments was 21 years ago, I moved from New York City to rural Tennessee, and I started keeping a garden. And, you know, that first season that I was gardening, I realized for the first time that in a garden, all of the cabbage is ready at the same time. All of the radishes are ready at the same time. And so, you know, just as a practical matter, what do I do with this cabbage? What do I do with these radishes? You know, I learned how to ferment vegetables. I learned from the joy of cooking. You know, it's really a very, very straightforward and simple process. And then from sauerkraut, I moved into yogurt making, country wines out of blackberries and elderberries and such. And then at some point I just became sort of obsessed with all things fermented and, you know, that led me into teaching, and that led me into writing books, and that led me into more teaching, and that's pretty much what I've been doing since then. And, you know, it's not only in the Western diet. I mean, really, people in every part of the world, you know, incorporate fermentation into their food traditions. There's a certain inevitability to microbial change to our food. And so, you know, our ancestors, you know, without specifically knowing about bacteria or fungi, you know, learned to work with these invisible life forces that are part of our food. And you know, basically, you know, we all see microorganisms spoil our food and
yeah.
The beginnings of decomposition. So just as a practical matter to avoid that, people had to learn under what kind of storage conditions, you know, would the food become more stable, more digestible, more delicious, rather than just decomposing into an ugly mess that nobody would ever want to put into their mouth.
And you did that perfectly. We're going right to the break, and we'll be right back to talk more about fermentation. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lindad, and my guest today is Sandor Katz. He's the author of Wild Fermentation and The Art of Fermentation, and his website is wildfermentation.com. And we'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Gadd, and my guest today is fermentation revivalist Sander Katz, author of Wild Fermentation and The Art of Fermentation, and his website is wildfermentation.com. So, Sander, I have to tell you that I really do love, love, love Wild Fermentation, the book. People who have been listening to me for a while and reading me a while know that I have certain ways of looking at the world, and you agree with me so much. So I want to just read a little portion that I circled this and put stars around it in the book. Okay. So you say, by fermenting foods and drinks with wild microorganisms present in your home environment, you become more interconnected with the life forces of the world around you. Your environment becomes you as you invite the microbial populations you share the earth with to enter your diet and your intestinal ecology. And we've been talking, there's a book called Missing Microbes, I think it's called. I had the author of that book on, and he was talking about how because of toxic chemical exposures like antimicrobials and antibiotics, that we're losing our microorganisms, particularly in our gut. And fermentation, or wild fermentation specifically, is restoring those microorganisms that are in your own natural environment that you live in, as opposed to buying a probiotic that is made in a laboratory and put in a capsule.
Well, I mean, from my perspective, the limiting factor with most probiotics is that they are billions of copies of one single kind of bacteria, or mm-hmm. Maybe two or three. But what I think of as our objective in, probiotic therapy, eating bacterially rich foods, is restoring biodiversity, rebuilding biodiversity.
Yes.
And so traditional fermented foods, which are the embodiments of these broad communities of bacteria, simply have greater biodiversity than, capsules with a billion copies of the same cell.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's like probiotics in a capsule, and I'm not trying to say that they're a bad thing. They're better than not having probiotics. Probiotics in a capsule is like the industrial version of the natural world, where industrial products tend to be all exactly the same, and the natural world tends to be diverse.
Yeah, and it's a monoculture.
Right. It's a monoculture. That's exactly right. And so what we're doing, so probiotics is a good step away from just eating processed foods with no biotics at all. But the next step then is to be making your own fermented foods at home.
You can also, buy foods that have been fermented. I mean, I think that the best thing to do is to ferment your own. But, I mean, there really are some, some very quality, local brands of fermented vegetables, fermented dairy products. It's possible to, get, good quality naturally fermented foods without making them yourself, but they'll always be better if you make them yourself.
Well, I have to tell you that after reading your book, the first thing I made was pickles.
And were you happy with how they turned out?
I was ecstatic with how they turned out, and I can hardly wait for summer to arrive so that I can make the pickles. And let me just say that these are so easy to make. Anybody can make pickles. And if you can still get those little cucumbers at your farmer's market or the store or wherever that are like pickle-sized cucumbers instead of huge cucumbers, all you need to do is, well, you can correct me. I'm sure I'm not giving all the steps. But it's pretty much as simple as putting them in a jar putting the pickles in a jar with dill and garlic and water and salt. And then they sit there in the jar, and 3 or 4 days later, you've got the most beautiful pickles you've ever eaten. What did I leave out?
No, you got it perfectly. You know, in cooler weather, depending on where you live, it might take longer than that. I mean, you know, in hot summer weather, it would probably, you know, really just be 3, 4, 5 days. But in cooler weather, or in a cellar or something like that, it would take longer. You know, the amount of time fermentation takes always depends upon the temperature. The metabolism of all these organisms goes faster when it's warmer. And you can really use the same method with other kinds of vegetables. I love to do it with string beans, with okra, with baby eggplants, with peppers. Mm. So if you want to leave vegetables whole or in big chunks, then you put them in a saltwater medium. If you want to cut up the vegetables in exposed surface area, then you don't need to add any water, and then you just dry salt the vegetables and let the salt pull water out. So that's like what I would call the sauerkraut method, is you don't add any water. You're just using salt and a little bit of pounding or squeezing to get the juice out of the vegetables. And the advantage of the dry salting method is that you're not diluting the flavor at all with water.
Right,
just getting
right.
the you know, concentrated full flavor of the vegetables themselves, you know, enhanced by the flavor of lactic acid, which develops over the course of the process. And you know, some people like it fermented for a long time, so they get a really strong acidic flavor. And some people prefer a milder flavor and let it just ferment for a few days. And, you know, one of the things about fermentation is that there really are no right or wrong answers. You know, it's just figuring out how you like it. And when people make these things for the first time at home, I definitely recommend that they start tasting it after a few days and just, you know, taste it at intervals every few days and just get a sense of the spectrum of flavors and figure out where they fit along that spectrum. And, of course, that's one of the great advantages of making anything yourself is, you know, you can figure out how you like it.
Absolutely. I remember when I was a kid, I come from a family where my mother was completely 100% Armenian. And so my grandparents on that side still cooked Armenian food and spoke Armenian and everything. And so once we made Armenian pickles right out of the Armenian cookbook, and we had to like cut them all up and buy a crock to put them in and store them in the darkness and all this stuff, and we had to wait a long time for these pickles. But it was fun. I should dig that up, and of course I don't have a crock anymore, but I could get a crock and dig up that recipe and try those pickles too. We need to go to break, but when we come back, we'll continue to talk about fermented foods. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest is Sandor Katz, author of the book Wild Fermentation, and his website is wildfermentation.com. We'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is fermentation revivalist Sandor Katz. I love that, fermentation revivalist, because he is reviving fermentation. I love that, you know, my field is really about going beyond industrialism and getting away from those toxic chemicals. And the way we get away from toxic chemicals is to do these old things, these old life-affirming things that people have been doing forever. This is just like such a toxic-free thing to do. And so it's great that you're reviving it. I just, everything from the past that works like this and is part of connecting humans to nature and utilizing the natural process and bringing us back to that connection deserves to be revived. I'm just 100% with you. So I want you, there's so much information in this book. I just, again, really encourage everybody to read it. One of the things that you talk about is cultural homogenization, how everything becomes standardized and uniform, and how fermentation is just the opposite of that. Could you just tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, sure. I mean, certainly, you know, I mean, fermentation takes place in giant factories also. I mean, you know, Anheuser-Busch is a fermentation corporation. You know, Kraft does all kinds of fermentation. So it's not that fermentation, cannot be industrialized, because it certainly has. But, you know, the nature of fermentation historically has just always been, like, every batch is a little different. And if you talk, you know, if you ever talk to, you know, a baker, you know, they'll you know, tell you about the realities that, you know, the humidity that changes every day, the temperature, you know, all these things, you know, affect the process of baking bread. So they have to be very adaptable. You talk to cheesemakers and they'll tell you, sure, I mean, every batch is a little bit different, and sometimes we understand exactly why, and sometimes we don't. And making sauerkraut, making kombucha, I mean, all of these things are, you know, there's so many variables. And ultimately it gets down to microbial communities, and microbial communities can be different in different places. I mean, there are generally broad patterns of similarity. It's not a question of, like, you know, Russian roulette, what kind of bacteria are going to be on these vegetables. I mean, as a matter of fact, lactic acid bacteria as a group are universally found on plants. The starter for vegetable ferments is just, it's always there. But, you know, the specifics of the community of organisms that are going to be present is always a little bit different. The environmental factors, which, you know, sort of have so much influence over which of those organisms can grow and at what rate will they grow, like, those are always a little bit different. So, you know, so really just entering into the realm of fermentation, is departing from the world of things being very, very controlled, and, you know, accepting a little bit of variability, and it kind of requires you to sort of observe and sometimes shift your expectations as things proceed. You can't necessarily predict what the temperature is going to be and what rate these things will proceed at. So, I mean, for me, I mean, I think that the practice of fermentation has been, you know, almost like a meditation. In, like, okay, you can't control everything. You want to set things up as best you can for success. Try to understand the conditions that you're trying to create, and then accept that you can't control everything and see how it goes, and, you know, keep on looking and thinking and adapting as necessary.
And being delighted with the surprising results.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell us, there's so many things that you have in the book about that can be fermented, vegetables, beans, etc. Just give us a little overview so that people can get an idea of the vast scope of fermentation.
Well, I mean, there's nothing that you could eat that you couldn't ferment. Which isn't to say that every single food has a tradition of fermentation. For instance, I've never seen any information about a historical fermentation of avocados. Doesn't mean you couldn't put avocados into your sauerkraut or your kimchi, or that you couldn't make a fermented guacamole, because I've done all of those things with really pleasing results. But, you know, anything you can eat can be fermented. So I always recommend that people start with the fermentation of vegetables, mostly because you don't need any special starter cultures. Like, you know, you could make kefir, you could make yogurt. There's lots of things you could make that you would need to find a starter culture. But with fermenting vegetables, everything you need is on the vegetables already. It's also just absolutely intrinsically safe. According to the USDA, there has never been a single documented case of food poisoning or any kind of illness arising from fermenting vegetables. So I think that's another great reason to recommend it to beginners. You don't need any special equipment. I mean, you certainly might decide that you would like an elegant crock to work with, but you can just work with a jar that's already sitting in your pantry. And you can enjoy your results relatively quickly. I mean, certain ferments, like if you want to make a miso, you know, most varieties of miso will age for a year or longer. So certain ferments just take a long time. But mm-hmm. fermenting vegetables, you can really enjoy your results within days. So fermenting vegetables is where I generally recommend that people start. You know, obviously, milk products are something that people ferment, and you can make yogurt, kefir, you know, other styles of fermented milk, you know, cheese if you really got into it. And, you know, many of those processes actually are quite straightforward, as well. But the only tricky part is you need to obtain your starter cultures. You also can ferment grains. I mean, in
sourdough.
Many parts of the world, the, you know, just the tradition of using grains is you always soak them in water first. Now, grains and legumes are interesting because, you know, nobody's fermenting them to preserve them. In their dried form, the way they are when they're mature, you know, a dried grain of wheat or of rice just preserves beautifully. Same with a dried bean. And, you know, it's not that they don't have microorganisms on them. It's just that they're so dry that the microorganisms are forced into dormancy because they lack the water that they need to function. So mm-hmm. as soon as you start to soak grains or legumes, you're kind of initiating a fermentation process that really begins a process that I would describe as pre-digestion and can make the grains and the legumes much more digestible, remove some compounds that can be potentially toxic if they remain part of them. And that can be just as simple as like soaking the grains, you know, overnight before you cook them, or longer if you want a more pronounced flavor.
I have to interrupt you because we have to go to break. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Landad, and my guest today is Sandor Katz, author of Wild Fermentation, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lindhad, and my guest today is fermentation revivalist Sandor Katz. He's the author of Wild Fermentation and The Art of Fermentation, and his website is wildfermentation.com. So, Sandor, this is the last segment of the show, so I have to ask you this now before we're done and we don't have time to talk about it. So I have some limited experience with fermentation, and while I think it is an incredible thing to do, and every fermented food I've ever eaten, I love. It's something that I haven't quite gotten the hang of to be able to incorporate it into my life. I'm still learning it, and so the kinds of things that I'm running into. First, let me tell you what I've made and the problems that I have. I have no problems making pickles. Pickles, all I have to do is make sure I have the ingredients, put them in the jar, and that's it. They're always perfect. And I should add that once you get it, you, as Sandor said earlier, that you should taste. And once you get it to the point where it tastes right, you just put it in the refrigerator, and it lasts and lasts and lasts and lasts and lasts. A lot of other foods in your refrigerator may go bad, but the fermented ones, I've never kept a fermented one long enough for it to go bad. I've also fermented beets by pretty much the same way of just putting it in with some water.
Okay,
and
so
salt.
Were you making a beet kvass?
I wasn't trying to make kvass. I was making just pickled beets.
Okay, great.
Pickled beets. So I cut up the beets, I put in some water and salt, and same as the pickles, and they were delicious. Absolutely
great.
Delicious. So I've also done kombucha. And the problem that I have with kombucha is that it's just kind of keeping track of the schedule of time. Because as you said before, you never know what's going to happen. And so I have my kombucha starter. And so then I knew, I forgot how many days it is now, 5 days or something. And then it starts getting really vinegary, like you can't even drink it. The whole thing about kombucha, listeners, if you don't know what this is that it makes a very wonderful drink that tastes delicious if you catch it right at the right time. And it gets bubbly, and it's almost like drinking champagne or something, you know, but it's very good. It's very good. And yet, if you let it go too long, then it, you just might as well put it on your salad as vinegar. It's not something that's drinkable. And it's just that discipline. You were talking about fermenting being like a meditation. To me, it's like getting the discipline in to be able to interact with your fermentation and get to know it and be able to give it attention. Because if you take that attention away, that's when you have a problem.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like you know the answer, which is just you have to begin, you know, tasting it sooner. And, you know, I would give it a few days and then just start tasting it every day. And, you know, just a tiny taste, a spoonful will tell you whether it's reached that point. But, you know, the acids accumulate over time, same in pickles or sauerkraut as in kombucha. You know, if you let sauerkraut go for months, you know, I mean, that's really the traditional way of eating it, is very, very sour. Some people prefer it more mild, but with kombucha, nobody really likes it when it goes to its logical conclusion. If you let it ferment for weeks and weeks, it starts to taste like vinegar. Mm-hmm. So people like it partially fermented. And so, you know, how many days will depend a little bit on temperature, because it'll happen faster if it's warmer, slower if it's cooler. But ultimately, it just depends on, you know, how sharp a flavor you like, how sweet you like it. And so, you know, the only way to determine that is to taste frequently. And, well, you know, your consolation prize isn't so bad. If you end up with some, you know, kombucha vinegar, then you can use that in salad dressings and, you know, in other kinds of cooking projects.
I found that it was that I'm just one person living by myself, and I was making it faster than
right.
I could consume it.
Well, you can make anything in any size batch. So I don't know if you were doing a gallon size batch, but maybe you just need to do a quart size batch. But you know, yeah, you can do it really small. If your mother, so let me talk a little bit about SCOBYs and the mother of kombucha. So the mother of kombucha is an example of a SCOBY, which is an acronym that stands for Symbiotic Community of Bacteria and Yeast. And this is a macro thing that we can see and hold. It looks something like a rubbery pancake that's the residents of a community of bacteria and fungi that are what are fermenting the sweet tea into kombucha, and it just floats at the top of your vessel. Kombucha requires oxygen. Some of those organisms are aerobic organisms that require oxygen. So a certain amount of the activity is right on the surface, and that's where the mother of kombucha floats. But you can just peel layers off of it each batch. It gets thicker and thicker. You can peel layers off of it. You can cut pieces off of it. Very, very resilient. You know, some people have the idea that if you know, cut a kombucha mother in half or in quarters, you'll kill it. That has not been my experience at all. They seem like they're extremely resilient. And they're also easy to find. Everybody who makes kombucha ends up with more mothers than they know what to do with, and people are very, very generous with their kombucha mothers. They're also widely available for sale if you're more comfortable buying them. But kombucha can be really delicious, and generally after the first fermentation, people will add a little bit more, you know, sugar or fruit juice or vegetable juice or herbal tea with a little bit of sugar, something, and then seal it in a bottle and let that added sugar ferment for another day or so, and that's how you get that, like, you know, really nice carbonation. And that's also a way to just incorporate, you know, different kinds of interesting flavors. A friend of mine swears by pineapple juice, and he just likes to, you know, add a little bit of pineapple juice to the kombucha for the secondary fermentation, and he consistently has, you know, beautiful fizzy kombucha.
Well, I have had really good success with kombucha. It's just that as a regular, I'm working on having more control over my own production of food, and I buy practically no prepared food. I'm always starting with the original ingredients, but it's a skill And it's also not just about learning the skill of producing one food at a time or one dish at a time, but also the management of time of all the, this production.
I'm a big advocate of labeling using masking tape and a marker. And, you know, labeling the date that you started things, the date that you think that they'll be ready. But, you know, especially if you once you have multiple projects going, just having, you know, the information at hand to keep track of how old it is. You know, you think when you make it that you'll always remember which day you made it on, but as the days pass.
Oh, no, you don't. You don't. I use Post-it notes, actually.
Great.
And so I have, I make my kombucha. I have one of those. You know, beverage serving containers that's got the little spigot on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Those are great for kombucha.
Yeah, and I haven't made kombucha in probably six months.
But those, I have my Scooby just sitting there. It won't get very fizzy. Like, it really gets fizzier if you seal it in a bottle.
Okay.
And add a little bit more something sugary, fruit juice, sweetened herbal tea, sugar, honey, anything, but just adding a little bit of something sugary in the bottle, and then sealing the bottle is how you trap carbon dioxide, although you also have to be careful that the bottles don't explode, which is another possibility that I address more at length in my second book, The Art of Fermentation.
Well, we're almost at the end of the show. We only just have a couple minutes left. Is there anything that you'd like to say that we haven't covered?
Well, I would love to just mention my website, which is wildfermentation.com. And, you know, not only are my books available through my website, but we have a support forum, links to all kinds of fermentation-related resources. You know, I guess I'll just – I'd love to, like, spend 30 seconds and just sort of, you know, talk about the idea that even though we've all been indoctrinated to think of bacteria as bad and dangerous, you know, right now, it's a very exciting time in microbiology because we're learning so much about bacteria and how important they are, and how the bacteria of our bodies outnumber our bodily cells 10 to 1, and they, you know, just give us so much of our functionality. Our immune system is mostly the work of bacteria. We're learning a lot about how, you know, serotonin and other chemical compounds that determine how we think and how we feel are regulated by bacteria in our gut. Just so many aspects of our physiology and functionality, it turns out, relate to the health of microbial communities in our gut. So we really have to sort of reject this war on bacteria thinking, the antibacterial soaps, the overuse of antibiotics, all the other chemical compounds that can kill bacteria, and really embrace bacteria as, you know, just an important, you know, part of the matrix of all life, ourselves included.
I completely agree with that. I think that I was just talking to a friend of mine last night about the yuck factor, that there's so many things that people just go, ooh, that's gross. And I think that the bacteria is one of those things that we kind of have this cultural training about this. But yet, if you look at the role that microorganisms play in life, they're fascinating and wonderful and amazing, and something that we should all be admiring and encouraging. And we should have more bacteria in our life, not less. And it's and yet we live in a culture where just the constant message is destroy that bacteria, that it makes you sick and you have to spray toxic chemicals on it and all those things. No, no, no. Prior to industrializations, people were exposed to bacteria in the world all the time. And yes, there are contagious diseases, but contagious diseases, you get contagious diseases because your body fails to be able to handle those harmful bacteria. But there are so many.
It's a lot about communities out of balance, microbial communities out of balance.
You know what? We have to go because we're like way past the time. This is Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Gadd. We've been talking to Sandra Katzen. Thanks for being with us. Be well.